This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay. They call it the Great Acceleration. In 1950, human activity departed from the old cycle of ice and warmer times into a new geological age. We do not know what it will be like or how far it will go towards an ice-free world. But now we have the formula in new science presented in this program. Then we go to Australia, where burning heat, searing heat, has created the ultimate fire conditions. That will happen more and more, not only in Australia, but in North America, the Mediterranean, and Russia. We'll talk extreme fires. I'm Alex Smith. Get ready with Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Continuing human interference in the natural systems of planet Earth could lead to, quote, abrupt changes in the Earth system that could trigger societal collapse. Now, that's not from a conspiracy blog, but in a scientific journal article published February 10th. And there's a lot more in that big picture from authors Owen Gaffney and Will Steffen. Owen Gaffney has a technical background as an astronautic engineer. He's a hybrid between an author of scientific papers and a communicator of big science issues. Gaffney aids the Future Earth Project. He's also the director of international media and strategy at the Stockholm Resilience Center. From Stockholm, Owen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much. Yeah, it's nice to be here.
In 2014, we had German journalist Christian Schwagerl announce the Anthropocene with his new book. What is the Anthropocene, and when did scientists realize we had entered a new geologic age?
Okay, so I guess the Anthropocene is the age of humans, and I guess that, in a nutshell, is a good starting point for a discussion. And what do we mean by the age of humans? Well, you know, technically geologists split Earth into various time periods. You know, the Jurassic is possibly the most famous, and the Triassic, the Permian. And, the last 11,700 years, Earth came out of an ice age and into a new geological epoch, the Holocene, which has been a remarkably stable period in Earth's history. And almost as soon as we came out of that stable period, agriculture emerged because hunter-gatherers could predict the temperature year on year, and planting crops suddenly made more sense. And from that, we had villages and towns and civilization flourishing. So we've been in this Holocene for 11,000 years, and now humans are changing the Earth system to such a degree that scientists say, well, actually, we're no longer in the Holocene. We're in a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene.
The deniers always say, Owen, that Earth has seen many climate changes. Prior to human intervention, briefly, what were the major causes of those heating and cooling periods?
Yeah, so I should say first that the geological epochs and geological changes are not always directly related to climate. Other events can cause a shift in a geological epoch. You know, a new evolutionary direction for species suddenly appears in the sedimentary record in the rocks, and this might signify a new geological epoch in some shape or form. But yeah, but many of them, yeah, are due to climate change. And so what causes the climate to change? Well, we have astronomical forces. We have the changes in Earth's tilt and its axis and its orbit around the sun, changes in the sun's heat output. We have other gravitational effects from Saturn and Jupiter, and also all blending to cause these astronomical changes. You know, a huge meteorite impact or asteroid impacts can knock Earth out of joint. Volcanic eruptions, so several of the cooler episodes in the Holocene over the last few thousand years, they've been caused by a spate of volcanic eruptions, putting huge amounts of sulfates, small particles, into the upper atmosphere, blocking the heat from the sun and cooling the planet marginally for a period. So these are the kind of natural forcings. Then you have tectonic forcings too. As continents collide, they can cut off oceans or cut an ocean in two, and then the ocean currents move in different directions, and then you get heat redistributed around the planet in a different way, or continents rip apart and open up new channels, and again heat can be redistributed in different ways, and then you know the Earth system then is dynamic and shift around to this new order. And you can get a shift in the climate and other things. You know, you get evolutionary shifts, you know, shifts to other parts of the cycle, the you know, nitrogen cycle, the water cycle, the sedimentary cycle, etc.
Well, you mentioned that we've been lucky enough to have about 11,000 years of relative stability to the point where we can say, well, this is sea level. We're not used to sea levels going way up and way down as they have in the past. But you do say in the paper, quote, Homo sapiens evolved during a rather unusual state of potential instability in Earth's history. So was the climate already potentially unstable?
Yeah. So we've been lulled into a false sense of security. So the Holocene has been remarkably stable, and a lot of Earth system scientists talk about this remarkable stability, which is true. But if we zoom out a little bit, you know, the Holocene is part of the Quaternary period and another level up. And the Quaternary, we've been in for about 2.5 million years. And during this period, we've gone into deep ice ages and then come out of them into these relatively warm periods called interglacials, and then back into deep ice ages, like a tick-tock cycle every 40,000 years for a while, and then every 100,000 years, and all largely related to Earth's orbit around the sun, pushing us slight shifts in it every and Earth's tilts and on its axis, and very, very slight shifts, which are measurable, can push Earth in and out of these ice ages. And this is actually a little bit unusual in that for millions and millions of years, Earth can go into deep ice ages with nothing, or very, very warm periods where there's very little ice, if any ice on the planet, very stable for millions of years. And suddenly, for 2.5 million years, we're in this period of just tick-tocking, just a slight forcings can shift us. And in the midst of this tick-tock cycle, suddenly emerges humans, Homo sapiens, on the plains of the Rift Valley in eastern Africa. And now, 200,000 years later, they're affecting the Earth system so profoundly that we're moving beyond the Earth system envelope of the Holocene, and in fact, moving beyond the envelope of these interglacial cycles into, you know, uncharted waters.
What is the Great Acceleration?
So, back in 2004, a group of scientists working at the International Geosphere-Biosphere Program published a synthesis, and it's this huge green book, academic text on the state of the Earth system. And, the International Geosphere-Biosphere Program at that stage had been running for about, since 87, so, you know, about 17, 18 years. They published this synthesis, and the program really brought together a lot of researchers working on oceanography and cryospheric research, the ice sheets, the atmospheric research, land use, and looking at the changes in the Holocene, and particularly this late Holocene and what people had begun to call the Anthropocene. And they put together a series of graphs in there, 24 graphs, and 12 of the graphs were looking at socioeconomic change since 1800, since the start of the Industrial Revolution, and looking at population growth, GDP, foreign direct investment, dams, farming, changes to the nitrogen cycle through using fertilizers, and tourism, globalization, as marked out by the number of McDonald's that had sprouted up. And then from these 12 graphs, there's another 12 graphs, sort of counterpart to them, looking at Earth system change, greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, nitrous oxide, methane, and changes to the water cycle, changes to biodiversity, changes to land use, deforestation, and changes to the oceans and biogeochemical cycles. And what's remarkable about these, all running from 1800, is that around 1950, they were growing steadily from 1800 onwards, and definitely significant growth compared with pre-industrial. But it really was in 1950 that marks the beginning of something really remarkable, where all of these graphs, all 24, just suddenly start bending upwards and accelerating, and until this day, continuing to accelerate. And it's quite obvious that the socioeconomic system is driving huge change in the Earth system. So this was known colloquially as the Great Acceleration. I think it was coined the Great Acceleration at the meeting in Germany in 2006. And then in 2015, Will Steffen and co-author of mine and colleagues Cornelia Ludwig and Lisa Deutsch and Wendy Broadgate, we published an updated version of the Great Acceleration graphs. We wanted to see what had happened 10 years on from the first publication and see if there had been any changes in the trajectory, to re-examine the data, see if there's any better data out there. And so we published, and again, I mean, what we saw was that the pattern is largely continuing very much so. We're still in the midst of this great acceleration. What we also tried to do was to look at some of the drivers as well, like you know, is it population growth per se or is it something different? And we were able to establish that, you know, population growth is obviously an important factor, but that by and large, the biggest factor is consumption and production of 1 billion people living in developed world in industrialized societies, as opposed to the 6 billion or so living in less developed societies.
We are going to talk about your large-scale formula for our current situation. But first, Owen, I can't get past figure 2 in your paper. On one side is a kind of universe of climate change with ups and downs of temperature, like the ice ages and hotter periods we talked about. But then we seem to have left that orbit for spaces unknown. Is that accurate?
Yeah. So in figure 2 in the paper, we show these basins of attraction. In complex systems, we draw these basins of attraction where you're pulled like a sort of gravitational force into a recurring cycle, and then slight changes can put you out of that cycle and into another cycle. So in the figure, and so it's almost like a sort of an Earth's orbit around the sun, but what we're talking about here is Earth's orbit around its into different stable states. And so we have the big glacial state. And then every 100,000 years, we will push into another orbit. You know, the gravitational forces will pull us into a different state, these interglacials. So we try to depict this as these cycles every 100,000 years. And we have a huge amount of evidence growing from the Earth system community that what's happening right now, since the start of the Great Acceleration, you know, caused by this huge socioeconomic growth, is that we're pushing Earth out of the basin of attraction of the Holocene, out of the basin of attraction of the interglacials, into something else. And we mark on it, well, we could be pulling ourselves into some sort of Anthropocene stable state, if such a state exists. We don't know if there's what kind of stable states are out there and what kind of pull will, what kind of attraction will take us into these stable states. And then I suppose far off on the horizon is this risk of going into the greenhouse attractor, which we know is a stable state of the Earth system. We know Earth has remained in that state for millions of years. So there's always that risk that what are the drivers or the pulls that would pull you into that. And these are still, you know, unknown questions that remain to be answered, which is why humanity is taking quite a big risk pulling ourselves beyond this interglacial boundary.
Well, one little problem along the way to that stable greenhouse state is the possibility of a sixth great extinction, which many scientists have warned is already in progress. I did interview Anthony Barnosky from the University of California about that back in 2009, and I noticed his 2012 paper is referenced in your paper. How big a risk is that, in your opinion?
Yeah, so again, as part of the Earth system change, we are the start of the, you know, a sixth mass extinction. I mean, and this is, to me, is quite incredible. You know, the last time we had a mass extinction on this scale was 66 million years ago, when an asteroid hit Earth and wiped out the non-avian dinosaurs. So, you know, this is the kind of scale humans are operating on. So this is largely down to land use, you know, land clearing. And we are causing extinction rates at rates, you know, 10 to 100 times faster than the background rate. And, of course, we, you know, the Stockholm Resilience Center, we talk about resilience a lot, the resilience of a system, and, you know, how a system can take knocks and then return to its normal state, like a spring. You pull a spring and it'll spring back to normal. But, you know, as you keep stretching the spring, it's not going to come back to normal as much, and it's not going to bounce back in the same way. And as you change a system, you can reduce its resilience. So this is part of the risk we're taking, is that, you know, the biodiversity. We know biodiversity enhances resilience. We know that if you have many, many species, then an ecosystem forest with many, many species can take knocks. It can bounce back easier than a system with very few species in it. So we're looking at the stability of the Earth system as a global interconnected system. And the concern is, though, that as we reduce biodiversity, then we reduce the resilience of that system, and we're already pushing the system in myriad ways, you know, greenhouse gas emissions, ocean acidification, the changes to the nitrogen cycle and eutrophication. So what we have been able to say and establish about the Earth system in normal circumstances may not apply in these new situations.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Owen Gaffney from the Stockholm Resilience Center. We're talking about leaving Earth's past behind, entering a new age created by human beings. Oh, and let's get to the new formula presented in this paper, the Anthropocene Equation. To be frank, it's a tough one for listeners to grasp, I think, and maybe even harder on radio. Why don't we start with this idea? Why is a mega formula needed?
So I guess when we published the paper in 2015 on the Great Accelerations, we were doing a lot of talks, lectures to the scientific community and public talks and, writing about it in the media and the scientific press. And we would use, similar phrases to kind of sum up what this great acceleration is, what, these thousands, tens of thousands of data points mean, which is this Earth system where everything's connected to everything else. Now humans are intrinsically connected into it and affecting it. And we're trying to sum this up in a kind of soundbite or just a sentence. And we'd say things like, humans now rival the great forces of nature, or humans are the prime driver of change on Earth, or, we're the size of an asteroid impact, or we're like an ice age. And it occurred to me that they are all very true. They sound rhetorical, these kinds of statements, and they're open to misinterpretation, I think. For example, you could say, we rival the great forces of nature. Okay, so one of the great forces of nature are tides, and the energy produced by tides is usually greater than the energy by humans, for example. But in terms of shifting the Earth system, we are miles greater actually than a lot of forces. Tides are net zero; they don't change the rate of change of the Earth system. Well, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, because when I was thinking about these statements we were making, I thought, well, is there a way we could formalize a statement around the Anthropocene that communicates more specifically the impact of humans? And so as I was thinking about it, I was thinking particularly about the rate of change of the Earth system, the speed the Earth system is changing, a bit like a car is going at 50 miles an hour or 100 miles an hour. So the miles per hour is the rate of change. So I thought the Earth system rate of change is something good, because we can look at this. Something we can measure the various components of. The biodiversity is part of the Earth system, changes to the ice sheets, changes to the oceans, changes to biogeochemistry, changes to the atmospheric concentrations of greenhouse gases, the key components of the Earth system that keep it functioning. We can measure the rate of change there for each one of those, and compare that to a baseline, and be able to say then what are the key drivers of that rate of change now. So that was really the starting point. That's why I thought we needed something like this.
So with this updated formula, can we now know what rate of human influence can continue and still allow a relatively safe habitable space on this planet?
Yeah, so our conclusion, maybe I could take us through the equations very briefly, because basically we start off with, for the last 4 billion years since Earth has had a biosphere, a sort of living resource on Earth, the rate of change of the Earth system has been a function of astronomical forces, the Earth's orbit around the sun, geophysical forces, volcanic eruptions and tectonic movements, and internal dynamics, as new species evolve, or as the system settles or moves into new states, and so now we're saying that back in 1999, an academic, Hans-Joachim Schellnhuber from Potsdam Institute, he published a paper saying that, well, now you have to include humans in here because humans are now a major driver. And so the rate of change of the Earth system is not just a function of astronomical and geophysical forces and these internal dynamics. It's also human forces. But he published that paper just 1 year before Paul Crutzen and Eugene Stürmer suggested that we were now in the Anthropocene. And 5 years before this book I mentioned earlier in 2004, when the Earth system and global change showing the great accelerations, and a decade before the first publication of the Planetary Boundaries paper. So when you look at the evidence in those papers and compare the current rate of change of the Earth system caused by humans compared with the background rate over the last 7,000 years, for example, you see that humans absolutely dwarf all other forcings by several orders of magnitude in most cases, from biodiversity to climate change to ocean acidification. So we can say that now the rate of change of the Earth system is a function of humans. The other forcings are still there, but they're orders of magnitude smaller, so they don't play a big role in the equation at all. I mean, you can discount them currently. That might change in the next few weeks if we had a massive, you know, Toba-like super eruption. But you know, currently, we can say, you know, for the last 40 years that's been the case.
So in the conclusion of this paper, it says, quote, "It remains unclear whether anthropogenic forcing is significant enough to drive the Earth system into a greenhouse state. That surprises me a little from some scientists I've interviewed. I thought our entry into a greenhouse state is more or less a given. What is the hope of avoiding it?"
Okay, so when we talk about a greenhouse state, we're talking about a state with very little ice on Earth. And these they have had these stable states before where carbon dioxide levels have been very, very high. And we've had, you know, hippopotamus on the poles. And there's palm trees and, you know, lush forests there, and you know, sea levels would be, you know, at least 70 meters higher than today, and the Earth would be operating in a very, very different way. There's you know, some scientists, James Hansen, formerly at NASA, and others have said that yes, we could have this runaway warming to pull us into that state, but the jury's out whether whether we can burn enough fossil fuels to fully do that, to fully tip us over into that that state. And we don't really know enough. You know, as I said earlier, we've sort of reduced the resilience of the Earth system through biodiversity loss and you know, changing the nitrogen cycle and water cycle. We're pumping out greenhouse gases, and we're in this no analog state. We can't say for certain what can happen. The big concern is that as temperatures get warmer, then the carbon sinks. So we pump out, you know, 10 gigatons of carbon every year. 5 gigatons of that carbon stays in the atmosphere, and it's cumulative. It stays there for thousands of years, so it just builds up and up and up as we emit more. But 5 gigatons is absorbed by the oceans and the land, so around 2.5 each. And these are really super important carbon sinks. They provide a huge service to industrialized societies. Yet, in a warmer world, will they remain carbon sinks, or will they become carbon sources? Is a big open question. And what will tip them? And you know, there's some research out just before Christmas saying that even the warmer world we have at the currently, at we're 1 degree above pre-industrial, heading rapidly towards 1.5. The research showed that by 2050, as we get to 1.5 and above, then carbon in soils will start getting emitted to the atmosphere, so causing more of a problem. And as we potentially hit other tipping points in the Earth system, you know, when we get to 3 degrees above pre-industrial, then we see places like the Amazon potentially dying back and becoming savanna and emitting large amounts of carbon. So you get these carbon feedbacks, these positive feedback loops where, you know, a warmer world begets an even warmer world, then potentially pulling you into this this hothouse attractor where it'd be, even if you stopped emitting greenhouse gases, you have this concern that the system itself is going to pull you naturally towards these this new basin of attraction. So, and this is alarming. We don't have enough information on exactly what will cause these kind of state changes, but we are taking risks as we wander into the unknown.
Well, I've used up quite a bit of your time. I hope you have just a couple more minutes. I want to ask you, as we finish off, about your views on the pivotal role of Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber, or John as he's known in the UK. Where does he stand in this exploration?
So John is extremely concerned about where we're heading politically. I think that in 2015, we made huge progress with the Paris Agreement on climate, with the Sustainable Development Goals. And there was huge, huge momentum and huge amount of energy. And that momentum is continuing. I think we have, the world is rapidly beginning to decarbonize. And the Global Carbon Project, one of Future Earth's projects that I'm affiliated with, we've shown that for the last 3 years, the growth in emissions has stalled. So there's been a huge, huge effort to address our fossil fuel emissions. I should say the growth in emissions of fossil fuels, and that's unexpected. Actually, the scientists didn't think this could happen; they hadn't predicted it, and it's largely down to China's huge efforts to control its emissions, to move rapidly away from coal. And then you can see sort of knock-on effects of that, of coal companies in Australia and the U.S. who are betting on China's increase in coal use. These companies are going bankrupt. We've seen 6 bankruptcies of the major coal companies in the U.S. since 2012. And the U.S. as well, it has been reducing its emissions, making big progress there. So there are some positive signs that we can deal with this, but will it happen fast enough? Emissions really need to peak by 2020 at the latest, and then fall precipitously to 2015. We're talking about some sort of we need a carbon law of halving emissions every decade from 2020, 2030, 2040 to 2050 to get down to zero as rapidly as possible.
We've been talking with Owen Gaffney. He's a science communicator for the Future Earth Project at futureearth.org. Owen also directs media and strategy for the Stockholm Resilience Center. All the while, he makes his own contribution to science through articles like this one, titled The Anthropocene Equation. Find links to all this in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Owen Gaffney, thank you so much for your explanations. It really helps.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. In recent years, extremely dangerous and damaging fires have dominated the news in many parts of the world. Just last month, a major forest fire ripped through Chile. Last year, the oil sand city of Fort McMurray, Canada, was almost destroyed. Are mega fires increasing? Will we see even more as the world warms? There's new research out about that. The title of a paper published February 6, 2017, in the journal Nature is Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events. We've reached the lead author, Dr. David Bowman. David Bowman is professor of environmental change biology at the University of Tasmania School of Plant Science. He's a visiting fellow or adjunct professor at 3 other Australian universities. From Hobart, Tasmania, David Bowman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hi. How are you going?
Oh, it's going pretty good here. Now, before we get to the science, David, you have a personal reason for studying fires. Could you tell us about that?
That's right. On the 7th of February, 1967, an extreme fire event occurred that engulfed really the whole of the Hobart area and very nearly burnt the city down. And that event, the 1967 event, really was what I was brought up with. I was trained by a Tasmanian fire ecologist, and there weren't many in those days. And his life was completely shaped by the 1967 event, when you have motor vehicles melted and suburbs severely impacted and so on. and 64 people dying in a small community, isolated community in those days, it still actually leaves a tremendous legacy. And part of the commemoration is that people from 50 years ago who were kids are still traumatised by what we call the 1967 Black Tuesday fire.
That is amazing, and I know what you mean. It has a very big impact. I've done some programs on super fires, and other people call them mega fires, but until now there really hasn't been a standard of what that means. What does your paper suggest as a good name and then as a measurement?
Well, that's right. We, in the fire science community, have been using the word mega fire, but there's been some discomfiture about the use of the word because it's very difficult to define. Is it a very intense fire? Is it a very big fire? Is it a very destructive fire? Is it a very historically anomalous fire? There are lots of ways a fire could be really big, a mega fire. What we did was two things. Firstly, we settled on the idea of energy as being a good index of fire, an extreme fire, and we avoided in our paper the use of the word megafire because it's an ambiguous term, and also the way we calculated these extreme fire events, we're not able to necessarily say it is a single fire, because as you know, during these extreme fire events, you may have several fire fronts, and firefighters may call each one of those fire fronts a separate name, as now it's becoming the custom that we generally name major fires. And so you could have several fires burning in a region, each one almost with its own individual character. And what we did was put a lattice down across the world, a 10 by 10 kilometre lattice, and then we looked at the energy of the hotspots detected by the MODIS satellite. The whole basis of the paper and our database was to say, well, if you sum all of those hotspots in a small area, that's a fire event. And then if you rank all of the fires we could observe in a 12-year period, some 23 million. And then what we did is we chopped off the top 500 and said, well, in anybody's language, the top 500 out of 23 million have got to be extreme. And then we studied those fires in detail to develop, I guess, a sample of extreme fires. Now, had we had more time, it's extremely time-consuming to attribute all of those 500 fires because we don't have a international database on fires. If we had an international database on fires, our paper would have been entirely redundant. We would have just, somebody would have already analysed that database, but it doesn't exist. There's no national, internationally agreed, and in many cases, no nationally agreed fire records. Some countries have better fire records than others. And what we were hungering for was an international perspective, because as many of your listeners would know, if you're interested in the environment, over the last 10 or 15 years, we're having reports of unusual fires, fires in Israel. And you go, that's odd, I didn't know they had forest fires in Israel, or fires in Greece, or fires in France, or fires in Chile, or fires in Australia, which I guess people know, but then extremely crazy fires in Australia, and then lots of them. So you need a global perspective to make sense of what's going on, and that's what our study did. And we used the index of intensity, and we looked at the most extreme events. And it would have been tremendous if we had more time. We would have looked at 5,000 or 10,000 events, but attributing them was a manual process. It was a painstaking verification process because we had to filter out events that also release flashes of energy, like volcanoes.
How did you do that? How could you verify that this flash of energy you saw was really a fire?
Well, we had a flow diagram, a verification process that we followed. And the way you verify these events is you need independent data streams. And so in the case of, is it a fire? The first thing you do is you look at the spectral properties of the energy. and we know that a forest fire will have a particular spectral signature. You then look at other satellite data, particularly area burnt data, and using other satellites indeed, and then you could go, well, at that location around that time or after that time, we can see a fire scar on the landscape. So that gives you a tick. And so you have to go through and be certain that there really was a fire. And then the next thing we did, which fed into this, is we wanted to know off our 500, and we winnowed it down to about 460, we rejected a number of them because they weren't verifiable as forest fires. We then wanted to know whether they were economically or socially destructive. And that was helpful also to verify they were fires, because generally really big fire events get reported in the media, and all of these fire events, if you will, had an address. And so we could search the web for reports in the media, or indeed in government, for fires at a particular time, at a particular location, or near a particular town. And then we were able to, again, verify that it was a fire, and also attribute whether it was destructive to human values.
Of course, there are some terrible fires in Siberia that aren't reported, and nobody has reporters in the Congo where there's civil wars and such, so it's possible that some important events could be left out or not.
Well, certainly in the boreal zone or in remote areas, even in outback Australia, believe it or not, we saw some extreme fires, and there's a reason for those extreme fires. We would be able to verify they were fires for sure, because our verification process, you can't disguise a fire scar in the boreal, you know, and that particularly hangs around for years. So we would be able to verify they were fires. Whether they killed people or disrupted infrastructure really got down to what was reported in the web and whether it was translatable from maybe Russian into English and interpretable in a way that you could attribute destruction. So we don't claim that we have a comprehensive, and I think in a sense, this is sort of one of the shocking features of our work. We don't claim we have a comprehensive database. Nobody does. That's shocking to me. Something as important as destructive forest fires, there isn't a global database. But we do have a very reliable sample, which enabled us to do what we call pyrogeographic analyses, or the understanding the geography of these fires.
And then you do undertake to discuss which are disasters in human terms and which are possibly natural wildfires, or at least not that damaging to humans per se. So what are the criteria that qualify these fires as a disaster?
The criteria that qualify disaster is economic impact, loss of life, or declaration of an emergency by the government in general terms. So it's something that humans care about. I think there's an important point here is that not all of these highly energetic fires are disastrous for humans. So there are big fires burning out in the backcountry. Now, they may be ecologically disastrous, and they may be contributing to carbon pollution, and they may be contributing to smoke pollution, which is affecting cities. And we didn't consider that. We just considered the direct impact on people and on people's livelihoods, infrastructure, and so on. So there's two important points here. One is that there are these fires out there that are having an effect, but they're not having a direct effect, but also these disastrous fires, which we were able to, as a subset, had a different geography to the background highly extreme events that we're talking about, this top 500. And they are concentrated generally in two places, the west of the North America, and particularly in the US, and the south of Australia. They're the real core areas, and emerging concern will be the Mediterranean. So there's something about those places, and it turns out it's climate, vegetation. So you've got the right climate, the right vegetation, but most importantly, the right settlement patterns. And the way you get a really good disastrous fire in the main, or to get this concentration of disastrous fires, is you create a combustible inhabited landscape, which is you intermix houses and the bush. And in fact, if you sort of, you know, think of what I'm saying, you know, that's like one way of saying it as a precursor to a disastrous fire. Another way of saying it, that's a really nice place to live. And there's the problem that as people get wealthy, they want to live outside the cities and they want to live with the amenity value of forests. Forests are, you know, very beautiful, peaceful places. People want privacy and clean air and so on. So they literally build into these forests. You know, we've all seen photographs of this. They're sort of grafting suburban existence into these forested landscapes without really any consideration of the ecology of these landscapes. And then there's, you know, of course, the hullabaloo when the fires come and burn down houses. And unfortunately, we're seeing in the Mediterranean this, I sometimes think of it as a socio-ecological pathology, because it's like all of these natural hazard crises, people building on floodplains when they know it's a floodplain because that's where floods occur. And then you say, oh, well, we'll build a flood barrier, and that makes it even more desirable to live there. So in the fire equivalents, we'll have better and better technology to put fires out. But then eventually the flood barrier breaks, or the fire technology can't cope with fires of such phenomenal intensity, and that's when you get death and destruction. And unfortunately, in the Mediterranean, due to land use changes, the traditional intensive landscapes, which didn't carry extreme fires, have become really quite dramatically overgrown with flammable vegetation. And simultaneously, there's, because of rural drift into the cities, poorer people, rural people, have been attracted to the cities, changing land use and economic policy. And then richer people are saying, well, I want to get out of the city. And so they go and start building back into these landscapes that used to have more traditional agriculture. And before you know it, in a bizarre sort of irony, the Mediterranean is becoming like the Western US and Southern Australia in terms of having a fire management crisis.
This is Radio EcoShock. My guest is Dr. David Bowman from the University of Tasmania. We're talking about human exposure to extreme wildfire events. Yes, the Mediterranean. Now, science suggests the climate of the Mediterranean will become hotter and drier, more like that of North Africa. I wonder, will that climate change add to the sort of human landscape risk that you've just described?
Well, that's right. We did a very simplistic climate future analysis, and it's simplistic. Projecting fire risk into the future is extremely difficult because it involves not only climate, but also involves the biology, the landscape ecology, and it also involves human ignitions and human settlement patterns. What we did is that we said, well, we know there's a threshold in the fire weather index where you get most, above this threshold, you get most extreme fire events. So that was sort of like a benchmark. And then we looked at each cell around globally, and we took some agreed projections, and of course they are projections, they're not predictions of future climate, and then counted up the number of days, the percent increase above that threshold into the future, so the mid of this century. And the alarming news is that it's certainly not going to get any better, but we're seeing between a 20 to 50% increase in the number of days where you could carry an extreme fire. And certainly the Mediterranean, right across the Mediterranean, jumps out as a place where we're going to see a real stepping up of fire risk. And this is, you know, completely consistent with many other studies. You know, there's now actually quite a burgeoning research field in Mediterranean fire ecology, because this is already beginning to play out. They're beginning to see extreme fire events. And, of course, we know about the heat waves in Europe and so on. So, you know, and in fact, that's what we're having right now in this summer in Australia and the mainland. We're seeing heat waves in the central east coast of Australia, particularly around Sydney and up into Brisbane. And one of the things our study suggested is this sort of further expansion of extreme fires up the east coast of Australia. And sure enough, this summer we're seeing quite a lot of significant fire activity to the north of Brisbane and affecting suburbs and making national news. So again, I would reiterate, you know, we're not in the business of predictions. These are pragmatic estimations of risk, lots of constraints, and there's lots of extra finessing you could do with this, but it's basically completely consistent with what everybody is saying, and there's a simple reason for why it's consistent with what everybody's saying, and that is that the precursor, one of the things our study showed, is that the precursor to extreme fire events is anomalous extreme weather events, particularly heat, but also stronger winds, dryness. Those things all converge to create the recipe, if you will, for extreme fire events.
You know, you're reminding me of a conversation I had with the Canadian fire expert Mike Flanagan, and my question to him was that climate scientists were saying the boreal forests, the northern forests of Canada, are going to get wetter and wetter as some areas further south get drier and drier, but we were seeing more forest fires up there. So I asked him, well, how can you have more forest fires if the area is getting wetter? And he said the answer is thin northern soil. It only takes 3 hot days, the kind of weather you've just talked about, for that soil to dry out, and then you can have a fire fairly soon after the rains. So, you know, it seems like it doesn't take a big change in climate to make a big difference for how long the fire season will run or the kind of fires we'll get.
Well, that's right. And an example, actually, of this, what we call antecedent or the preceding conditions, in Australia, in the outback, we can get extreme fires if you have a wet season, like we've had in some parts of the outback this summer. You get a lot of rain, and that makes basically the outback, which is generally arid, like the tropics, because it's really warm and wet, and you get an incredible production of biomass. Now, of course, it during the dry season, it switches back to being very hot and dry, and normally you don't get a lot of fire up there because there's no biomass, because it's a desert, if you will. It's an arid environment, so it's low vegetation productivity. But when you get this extra rainfall, you can get a pulse of fine fuels, and then, you know, if you get a hot, dry season, you can get these spectacularly big fires which will burn across the core of the continent. So that's exactly right. It's a very paradoxical situation that even wet springs in southern Australia, we have the same problem like we've had this last spring, where it's been very wet. You get a lot of production of fine fuels, and then it's really a waiting game, and we're in exactly that place here in Tasmania. It's been a very warm, consistently warm summer, but no heat waves yet. So everything is just sort of on simmer, but there's this huge pool of hot air on the continent, which is actually currently being vented out into Sydney. So, you know, the city of Sydney and Brisbane have been having these, you know, just stupendously historic, you know, unbearable heat, you know, really affecting the headlines and city life. But were that heat to be channeled southward into Tasmania, even this fire season, we could see trouble. And part of the reason for trouble is because we've got so much fine fuel from the wet spring.
I remember seeing those pictures of fires in Tasmania where there was a family huddled around a dock while the whole sky blazed above them. But at that same time, there was a much less reported fire in northern Tasmania, was there not? And it was an important preservation area. Could you tell us about that?
Well, it's actually in the west. So Tasmania is a it's an intriguing island that it's basically split on the western side. It's very, very low density. And it's a little bit like a miniature boreal sort of situation. It's got organic soils, some dense forests, some, like, you know, open boggy vegetation, which is, you know, I guess, almost analogous to a tundra. And that vegetation will burn only when it's extremely dry. And what happened is in the last 4 years, in 2013, when there was a very hot extreme fire event, which actually the Dunalley fire event, which the family hiding under the pier, was in our top 500 database. As that happened, there was a giant fire occurring in Western Tasmania under these very severe weather conditions. So that really highlights, I think, a key point that you can have an extreme destructive fire. The city of Dunalley, or the township of Dunalley, was basically destroyed, and people were running for their lives, jumping into the sea. I mean, truly incredible story. But on the other side of the island, where nobody lives, there was just this huge fire. It was, in Tasmanian terms, it was 46,000 hectares, and nobody was fighting it. It just was burning, and it was burning into the peat, and the smoke was coming out of the that wilderness into Hobart, polluting the atmosphere. And then what happened last fire season, the 2016 fire season, an extraordinarily dry spring, just a ridiculously dry spring, historically truly off the wall. Lightning storms ignited about 90 fires in the west, and they burnt for 60 days, and they were burning into wilderness areas which have some Gondwanic vegetation, relic vegetation, really weird Gondwanic ancestors to the giant redwood pines and all sorts of curious and odd plants that of which there are fossils in Antarctica. I mean, these are really, you know, some of these things have been unchanged for almost 100 million years. You know, they're very unusual vegetation which can't withstand fire at all. These environments were actually under threat because of the incredibly huge and slow burning, because it was in the peat, in the organic soils, burning fires. But that wouldn't qualify, according to our definition, as an extreme fire. It didn't. Maybe there was a few occasions where it might have been an extreme fire, but most of it was actually slow moving, just under the influence of extreme drought.
Now, in this paper, you make another really important point. We're going to have to wrap up soon, but you say that cities recognize earthquake risk. They make bylaws. We spend a lot of money to reduce earthquake damage and prepare the population. But we don't do the same for fire, and especially with climate disruption coming. What can we do to make our cities more fireproof, or at least help the population escape if they need to?
Well, there's absolutely a huge amount of information about how to make cities more fireproof. I've had the privilege of visiting Vancouver. And again, Vancouver is sort of like, in my mind, a giant version of Hobart. It's a city, particularly the north side of Vancouver, it's a city which is going to get really hammered by an extreme fire event. It's got all of the symptoms of people building into vegetation that can support fire. They have no experience of fire. There's an aversion to clearing around houses because people want amenity value. And even the Canadian government has provided, the British Columbian government have provided funding to clear around communities. There's very limited uptake because there's, in other words, we've got all of the knowledge to make, or not all of, but most of the knowledge we have to make cities and settlements significantly more fireproof. But that requires changing the landscape. And the biggest break on this is actually the appetite in the community for that change, because it's contrary to what most people are living in these places. They don't want to see the forest thinned out. They don't want to see fuel treatment. They don't want to spend the money on making their houses fireproof. They're living in la-la land, really, that we're just, you know, thinking, and same thing in Hobart. We're just sort of winging it. And we go, yeah, we know 50 years ago Hobart nearly burnt down, but, you know, we're really going to fight tooth and nail if somebody starts trying to, you know, do interventions which are going to cost money or affect the amenity value of my suburb or my backyard or whatever. It's basically being put in the too hard basket socially. And my prediction is that the only way we break through this is, and maybe even that is, we have to have an event, another event like the 1967 event in Hobart, to really get this right at the very top of the political agenda. Even the Dunalley fire there was a government inquiry. There was lots of improvements in fire management and so on, but it's getting it to be stuck onto the community. We know that there's a large, from surveys and inquiries, we know there's a large number of people living in a place like Hobart that just are in denial. They just don't believe the message. They don't want to hear the message. And I think the tragedy with climate change denial is that we've already got a really bad problem, which would be existing even if it wasn't for climate change. But climate change is making a bad problem much worse. But in a sense, the denial aspect of it almost works in the opposite direction of getting adaptation, because people were saying, oh, well, you know, it's not really certain that there is climate change. And then once you introduce doubt into all of this conversation and you already are inclined not to do anything, then it plays to your advantage. You know, you want to hear what you want to hear. And so you go, well, there's no problem, so we'll just keep living dangerously. And people aren't even aware they are living dangerously until you have something like a Fort McMurray event where you go, that just wasn't meant to happen. But translating the anger and the grief from these events into adaptive responses, that's a really big project.
Well, we'll see whether we can do it with climate change. As you say, it's human resistance. And I did a program with a person who said that human denial was just a part of the way our brains evolved, and it's very difficult to get rid of. So I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, David. It's been really fascinating talking with you. We've been discussing the paper, Human Exposure and Sensitivity to Globally Extreme Wildfire Events, and that was published in the journal Nature on February 6, 2017. Our guest is the lead author. I'll put links to this paper and other fire interviews on Radio EcoShock in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That comes out on Wednesdays. David Bowman, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, pleasure. Good on you. Thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. In America, the man who swore to dismantle the Environmental Protection Agency has been approved to head it. The last of the EPA staff from Obama days have established a mirror site to preserve the climate change and species information provided formerly by that agency. Meanwhile, in Berkeley, teams of young people have downloaded reams of databases from NASA. They've also set up software to track changes and deletions by the Trump administration. That's it. We are reduced to saving what we can before the new dark age of denial. But we know what time it is on the big clock. Our planet is weaving out into a new form, heading through floods, fires, and storms towards the gate of mass extinction. Our children and descendants are in danger. I will continue to bring you cutting-edge science, activism, and information you need to know. Please pass it on as far and as wide as you can. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world.